Spread Aviation Nation. Welcome back to the Spread Aviation Podcast. I'm Rob.
I'm Matt.
And we're here by remote this time. So I'm in the Man Cave Studios, and Matt is on the road celebrating birthdays and stuff for important people in his life, which, hey, that's important too, right?
I am. I'm in Chicago for the seventh time in the last 45 days. Lots of traveling.
All right. Well, I mean, that's important stuff, you know. have you had any interesting adventures while you were traveling these last seven times?
Well, Sarah and I went to Portland. We hiked Camelback Mountain in Phoenix, which was awesome because you have a great view of Sky Harbor Airport. So I sat up there for half an hour kind of geeking out while everybody was like, what are you looking at? I'm like, oh, those planes over there. It was awesome. I didn't actually know this, and I could be wrong, but did you know Sky Harbor is actually like two towers? There's a North Sky Harbor and a South Sky Harbor.
I did not know that.
And then I came back to Chicago, spent a couple weeks here, then went back to Boston for 5 days, then came back here 3 days ago because it was Sarah's birthday. And I've been here ever since. Went to Northerly Island yesterday, did a little bit of walking around MIGS again. And yeah, that's about it. That's the only aviation-related thing I've done in Chicago. I will say that I flew into O'Hare on Saturday night, and it was absolutely empty. It was literally empty. We landed, pulled up to the gate, and I was the only one in the airport. And it was like 8 p.m. I was very impressed.
What day?
Saturday night. Like, if you're going to fly to Chicago, fly here Saturday night. You'll be the only person in the airport.
So, I mean, it's a holiday weekend, yeah, but it doesn't...
There was hardly anybody there. Yeah.
Where did
I looked at Flight Radar 24, and it was completely dead. Like... We landed, and the next plane coming in was like halfway over Lake Michigan. It was crazy.
Huh. Wow, that's definitely rare, rarefied air, if I may. Yeah, I was driving this weekend. I drove down to New York, New Jersey area, and the traffic there was moderate to heavy. And then on the way home, it was actually heavy. Waze had me on some back roads. Bypassing sections of 84 because they were just red. And there were some really nice back roads to be on, but it seemed like everybody else that was using Waze was also on these back roads. But really beautiful fall colors right now. You know, it is October and the leaves are just starting to change in this area, and we're getting into the really nice oranges and reds and yellows and things like that. So it was a nice drive.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm jealous. Everything looked really nice when I looked at the pictures. Like, people have been posting pictures on Instagram. It's looked really pretty. But I am running a 5...
It's turning into NPR. Hold on.
it's turning what?
It's turning into NPR right now.
Talking about the beautiful colors of the leaves and the trees. And how it was a magnificent afternoon and evening. And I was overlooking Sky Harbor Airport. And everyone was wondering, What is that curious man doing on top of that hill?
Yeah, no, we got to talk about airplanes. Okay, so we you had posed, I don't know, not necessarily a question, but you want to fly a new type of airplane, which I have no objection to. Tell me about this.
Well, actually, I just want to understand. I mean, one of the things I've been talking to some pilots recently, and one of the things that people have been asking me, which I, of course, know nothing about considering I'm still a student, is what is it like to transition to a more complicated aircraft? And I say more complicated, not using the term complex aircraft, because the complex aircraft is a specific type of aircraft, and you can go into that in a second, but just more complicated than, say, a Cessna 172 or a Cessna 152. Like what is that process like to transition to it, whether it's a tailwheel aircraft, whether it's a more powerful aircraft, horsepower-wise, whether it's retractable gear, whether it's I don't even know if you get to the point where there's general aviation
aircraft with slats, for example.
What?
You're asking 17 questions without even knowing it. No, you're doing great. You're doing great.
What do you mean I'm asking 17 questions without even knowing it? I know exactly what I'm asking.
Yeah. Well, let me just kind of get to the answer. I don't mean to cut you off at all, but
That's fine. You
start talking about space shuttles, like, the interesting thing about moving on, like, most people start off in a Cessna 172 or, say, a Piper Cherokee, And these are very simple airplanes with not a lot to do. And they're great because of that, because they can teach you the basics of flying. And these are foundation level skills that you can take to whatever you're going to get into after this. My background is that I've flown over 37 different types of airplanes at this point, at one helicopter and two blimps. So those don't really count as much as anything else. But on the airplane side of things, what I've noticed in flying a bunch of different airplanes is how similar everything is. Meaning that when I pull back on the stick, the nose goes towards my forehead. And when I push forward, the nose goes towards my feet. And roll and yaw are all the same. And how the aircraft reacts to power, how I use the power, is really all the same. But there are differences in quantity and feel and feedback. If you're getting into an extra 300 that has 300 horsepower and it weighs 500 to 800 pounds less than a 172, you're going to have a big difference in response. You're going to have a big difference in performance. And also, control feel is very, very light. Whereas if you go from a 172 to, say, a 182, you're going to notice how much heavier the controls feel, especially in pitch. The airplane's a little heavy in pitch. But all in all, it flies like an airplane, and it does what you tell it to do. So there's not a whole lot to relearn when you're getting into a new airplane. So if you have the opportunity to transition to something, don't think that you're resetting your knowledge base at all. You're just taking things you already know, getting into a new airplane, applying them, and then learning some of the new things that may come with that new aircraft. If you're going from a 172 to a Piper Cherokee 160 or 180, there's not going to be a whole lot of difference there, except the view is going to be different. You can't see down in the Cherokee as well as you can in the 172, and vice versa. If you're used to raising the wing to clear before you make a turn in the 172, well, if you're in the Cherokee, you can already see, if you raise the wing, now you're blocking your view. It's just a little different that way. So there are little differences between the airplanes. But if you're transitioning, say, to something that requires a new endorsement to be the pilot in command of, like a tailwheel airplane or a complex airplane, those usually come with a bit of training built in.
Generally, why is that, Rob? Why are there some aspects of more complicated aircraft that require an endorsement and some that don't?
Because now, as things get more complicated, there are new ways to kind of screw things up. And so you want to get this training about these new things in order to prevent those screw-ups and keep yourself safe as long as possible. So the reason that there are certain aircraft that require endorsements to fly is purely because of safety. We don't just want you getting tossing you the keys to the your dad's Corvette and saying, go have fun on Saturday night, you know, and be good, you crazy kid, after you've been driving the minivan. No, that's not going to go well. That's a recipe for disaster. So when you get into these more complicated airplanes or airplanes that have special characteristics, you want to get more training. And the FAA has required that by requiring endorsements in order to fly things like tailwheel airplanes, complex airplanes, high-performance aircraft, and even to go above flight level 250, going above 25,000 feet. So with a tailwheel airplane, it is unstable in ground handling, whereas the tricycle geared airplanes of the 172 and the Piper Cherokee, they are stable in ground handling. And if you're not prepared for that new instability and how active you're going to have to be after landing, you could put yourself into potentially dangerous situations, including but not limited to the ground loop. Complex aircraft that have controllable pitch propellers, movable flaps, and retractable landing gear. The landing gear is a big area where if you get that wrong, you're definitely damaging an aircraft and possibly putting yourself at risk. And so with the complex aircraft, I generally say there's two groups, pilots that have landed with the gear up and pilots that will land with the gear up. And the purpose of my training is to ingrain into you very, very strongly that you put that gear down every single time you're coming in to land. And that way you delay as long as possible the joining of the first group of those pilots that have landed gear up. And generally that's going to be 5 to 10 hours of training, kind of same with the tailwheel, 5 to 10 hours of training, somewhere in there. And those endorsements are earned. You need to demonstrate proficiency in order to earn those sign-offs. It's not just, oh, I did my 5 hours, give me my sign-off. No, 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 no. You had to be prompted to put the gear down. You had to be prompted to do the short final check. You had to be prompted to verify that it was down. If I'm still prompting you to do these things, you're not ready yet. And part of what I will do also is load up a little bit of stress and put you in an artificial stressful situation so that I can evaluate how you're going to respond with those procedures and how ingrained those procedures are in you, the pilot, now dealing with all these different things, because inevitably there's going to come a day when Mother Nature throws something at you that you're going to have to deal with, and you're going to have to handle it, and you're still going to have to get that gear down.
And
to deal with the emergency procedures.
Now, Rob, the definition by the FAA of a complex aircraft is kind of like you mentioned, retractable landing gear, constant speed propeller, and movable flaps or adjustable flaps.
Controllable pitch propeller. I'm just gonna throw that out, the controllable pitch propeller, because there's even different types that aren't constant speed.
Okay.
Whole other topic.
Got it. So another question I have is, why do you need all three of those for it to be, for you to have a required complex airplane endorsement? So for example, if you are just as a private pilot transitioning to a plane that has retractable landing gear or a plane that has controllable pitch propeller, but it doesn't have both, is there for some reason that then, Is it somewhat safer that you don't actually need that endorsement, or would you still recommend getting that endorsement?
No, it's not required that you get the endorsement if you're flying, let's say, like a Cessna 177 Cardinal or a 172 Hawk XP. Those aircraft had constant speed propellers, which count as controllable pitch. They had movable flaps. But unless you were in the RG version of the 177, you did not have retractable landing gear. So you only had two of the three legally required items that make the aircraft complex. And when you add that third element, it's just like adding one more ball to a juggler or one more bowling pin. It's just that one extra little thing that may push you over the top. And so when you only have to manage the propeller and the flaps, you're not as workload task saturated. And if you screw the flaps up or you screw the prop up on a landing, it's like it's no big deal. Oh, you forgot to put the flaps down? Oh, whoop-de-doo. Okay.
Right.
Oh, you forgot to bring the prop full forward? Okay, as long as you didn't have to go around and you weren't at 2300 or 2100 RPM. Okay, it's fine. You know, it's not a big deal. But once you add in that gear, now it gets rather interesting. What I can't think of an example off the top of my head is an airplane that has a constant speed propeller, controllable pitch propeller, retractable landing gear, and no flaps. I'm not coming up with anything that has that. But there's one more thing that I haven't mentioned, because, say, the Cirrus kind of fits this bill, but so does the DA-42 Twin Star. It's a multi-engine airplane, but it only has a power lever for the engines. It doesn't have a prop lever. It has what's called a full authority digital engine control, or a FADEC. And that aircraft, the pilot is not directly in control of the pitch of the propellers, the computer is commanding power and changing the pitch of the propellers as conditions change. And so the FAA, when this technology came along to general aviation aircraft, made sure that they threw in that language into the regulation. to say, hey, yeah, BADEC aircraft are also complex aircraft.
Interesting, interesting. Got it. That's not something that we would have known, so that's good that you shared that. So I guess my final comment on this is, you know, I'm finally starting to understand why in my first lesson with you, you said GUMPS check, and I said, okay, well, what's that stand for? And you said, you know, gas engages, undercarriage, mixture, power, switches, and seatbelts. And I was like, undercarriage? It's a 172. Why do I care about undercarriage? Well, now I know. You're forming good habits, because if you, you know, then later switch to a complex aircraft that does have retractable landing gear, you're already going to be used to checking.
Man, I'm glad you picked up on that, because that's going to save us a whole lot of work when you buy your 182RG in the future. You're 210. Ooh, 210's a nice airplane.
Exactly. It's already hammered in my head.
Yeah, you know? And as a flight instructor, I'm not preparing you to fly a 172. I'm preparing you to fly airplanes, and you may someday get into that, and that's absolutely why I do it.
Yeah, it's really, really good. It's funny how that comes together later on. I always just thought that, you know, a 172 is such a crappy airplane that the wheel could fall off, but now I understand what you're
Well, we had that Beverly, what was it, a little over a year ago, I think, at this point, where that girl, she was on, not her first solo, I think it was her second solo, in a Piper Cherokee, and she took off, and the left main or the right main gear fell off. Like,
oh, wow.
All right, and the tower informs her, and she's just like, okay. And the tower, what do you want to do? I want to come back and land. Like, okay, you know, like. It was very well handled, but that stuff happens. But in a low wing, you're not going to see that.
Yeah.
You're not going to know that gear fell off. Like, you're going to have to be told by somebody on the ground. I don't remember the exact situation. I could probably find the audio for it from Live ATC, where she might have been on final, and an airplane holding short said, hey, that fell off, or might have taken off, and an airplane holding short saw it fall off the airplane. So.
Oh, wow.
Very, very interesting situation.
Hey, Maggie, this is Greg. How you doing?
As good as it gets, I guess.
Yeah, listen, it's going to be okay. So you got plenty of fuel. You got the aircraft under control. So you're just going to continue circling. John's going to be here shortly, and we'll keep you updated, but we'll work it out.
Do this just like we did. I know it's hard to say this, but treat it like a normal landing as you can. So the power settings we've always done, the pitch for the airspeed, keep everything as normal as you can.
All right.
So, Maggie, the other thing is we've looked at the part. We pulled that off the run. We've looked at it. Greg and I have looked at the airplane through binoculars, so it's your right wheel that's missing. So as you land, the plus side here is you get a little bit of a left crosswind. So if you use your normal left wing crosswind correction, that means the left side will touch down first, and you're just going to ease the right side down. It's going to try to pull to the right, so be prepared to use as much left rudder and left brake as you have to try to keep it on the center line.
All right.
Yeah, beautiful job, Maggie. You got a whole bunch of people clapping for you up here.
Hi.
Now, how would you land in that situation in like a 172? Is it just was it the mains or was it the nose wheel?
Yeah, no, it was her main.
Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
So in that one, you know, you're gonna bend some metal, and the idea here is to bend as little as possible. And I cannot necessarily advocate any one technique over the other. I can only really say what I would do in that situation. And I would set myself up on an angle down the runway, not necessarily on the center line, but I would actually try to land in a bit of a side slip angled to the side of the runway of my good tire, and then hold it on the good tire as long as possible. And then when it sets down that bad side, I know it's going to pull me hard to the bad side. So if I'm already pointed and tracking and going towards the good, it's giving me room. I'm using geometry now in order to maximize the amount of room I have to get this thing stopped safely, and using what I have for control authority to make sure that when it touches, I'm going as slow as possible in order to have that next event, which is going to be kind of like skidding in a car sideways as brief as possible and reduce the risk of a rollover.
Got it. And I guess in that case, you'd probably want to try to get as slow as possible as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I want to slow down with the good main already on the ground.
Got it.
So I'm not saying I'm going to come in any faster, but I'm going to need to make sure I have enough speed to where I have the control authority to put the airplane where I want, hold it off, and then get it slow as I hit maximum deflection of the controls, mm-hmm. and it starts to settle on its own, kind of like you would do in a really, really strong crosswind.
Got it. Well, that's helpful. That makes a lot of sense. Speaking of which, this has absolutely nothing to do with our next topic. I was trying to make a transition, but it didn't work. Mike Linden's ready to talk to us from My Radar, so I think we should switch over to that.
All right, excellent.
All right, so Spread Aviation, we've got Mike Linden joining us from My Radar. Let's get right to that.
Hello, Spread Aviation Nation. This is Rob, and Matt's here too. Say hi, Matt.
Hi.
And we are excited to have a very special guest today. Those of you out there who are tech savvy may have seen this app out there, especially if you're interested in weather. And that app is My Radar. I know I've used it personally just coming from U.S. Aerobatic National Championships. We were watching the weather that was developing down in Texas coming up into Kansas. And this radar app really helped us out. So today, we are interviewing Mike Linden, and we're going to let Mike tell us a little bit about himself and what he does with My Radar. Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am in addition to being a meteorologist, I'm the director of video and social media content for the My Radar weather app. We're based out of Orlando, Florida, but we have an office as well in Portland, Oregon, so covering the United States from coast to coast. Prior to this, I was involved with television news, jumping from state to state, station to station, covering the weather as well. But now I've entered into the world of the digital weather world, and with that, so much more comes with it, along with our digital coverage of events like Hurricane Dorian, as well as down to the aviation stuff, which is a whole new can of worms. There is so much to get into when it comes to what you can do with the app and how you can apply to the world of aviation.
Absolutely, and I was exploring a little more of the functionality of the app, knowing that this interview was coming up, because, I mean, I was just using it to get a radar picture, and that's
right.
Maybe 10% of what the app does. And I got to see some of the other layers that are in here and some of the other applications for this. So what can a pilot use this app for besides just getting a nice, pretty picture?
Yeah, I mean, the best part about the app in and of itself, and of course I'm a little biased, but I just love how customizable it is. Whether you simply want to turn it on and see whether or not it's going to rain for you on the ground, or if you want to see where a wildfire is and what the current information is, you can do all of that within the app. But when it comes to aviation, all of those features are really cool. Now, you have to upgrade to the pro version of the app, and then there is as well a separate charge for aviation charts. But again, it's so customizable with things that you can do, from looking at the AirMets as well as the current SIGMETs that are in effect. You can look at TFRs. You can click on information to see, again, those full detailed reports. It simply won't just show you a blob on a map and show you a TFR. You can tap on it. It'll give you all the information that you need before you take off. You can even enter in your flight number. Just as long as your flight is registered with the FAA, you can not only see where your flight's going to go, but you can track it as it's going, maybe for somebody on the ground. Maybe a little tough for you to follow along as you're flying, but for someone along the ground, you'd be able to follow along with the flight plan as long as you have that tail number.
Yeah, I mean, the holidays are coming up at the time that we're recording this. So, mm-hmm. Well, you know, you got people coming in from out of town for Thanksgiving, Christmas, anything like that. This could be an app that you're using to track whether they're on time or not, right?
Absolutely, and we actually have another feature in the app. The list goes on, where if you have an account with TripIt, if not, it's really easy to sign up. All you have to do is register with an email address. And what will happen is, once you have that tied into the My Radar app, when you are at an airport and you have signed up through TripIt and have entered your flight information there, it will not only be able to detect when you're at the airport, but it will show you your gate, whether or not there's any delays, And again, so you can follow along with your flight as you're at the airport. So it's kind of a one-stop shopping rather than having to jump over here to see what the weather is going to be and how that could affect your flight or where the destination is for your particular flight. But it will also, again, give you the information before you even get to your gate. Maybe you're waiting on the security line. You want to see what the potential impacts are rather than jumping around between all these apps. It's right there.
Right, so this is not just an app for pilots. I mean, this has some great usage for non-pilots as well, people who are interested in weather. And one of the things that I'm digging as I'm looking at this thing right now, and hopefully we'll post a screenshot of this, I can see the fronts, the frontal systems that are happening across the U.S., and because it's showing me the radar picture and it's showing the weather that's happening right underneath that stationary front out in the Midwest, I can use that as a teaching tool with my students to go, hey, we see, you know, on this prog chart, we see these fronts here, but what might be happening? Well, let's combine that with the radar and, oh, hey, look, there's thunderstorms, there's snow, there's hail, there's all kinds of weather things that could be happening. And so now we get some understanding that with this frontal system, hey, we're going to have change. We could be seeing weather and the types of weather that we could see.
That's a really cool tool. Yeah, I'm glad that you're enjoying it. That's one of our newest features, coupled with you can now not only see the winds at the surface, but you can also see the jet stream winds, and it will animate out for you. You can even change the colors in case you want it to look a particular way. But that front feature was one of the most requested that we've had certainly recently to be able to, again, like you said, to be able to zoom into a really finite level to be able to see what's going on not only locally but regionally, statewide, and even wider as well. So I'm glad that you're finding a use for it. Education is one of our biggest goals, to be able to not only help people to understand, hey, it's going to rain, you got to bring your umbrella with you, but maybe if you want to dive a little bit deeper into the world of meteorology and even into aviation too, you know, you can take it step by step and really kind of jump right in yourself.
All right.
Now, Mike, one really quick question on this. So I think a lot of our listeners have different apps that they can kind of couple together to get some of this functionality. When I'm thinking about your competitors, I'm thinking that, you know, a lot of this functionality is available. You just maybe have to use three or four different apps to get there. And it sounds like you guys combine this all into one. What else would you say is a differentiator of MyRadar compared to your competitors? What are, like, things you're trying to focus on that really differentiate yourself from other apps?
Well, we are, as far as I know, the only digital weather app with a full-time team of meteorologists, including myself, Chief Digital Meteorologist Leslie Hudson, who has years of especially tropical forecasting. Hurricanes are the name of the game for her. And we also have a new meteorologist to the team, Stephanie Lauber. So as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I know, rather, we are, again, the only team of full-time meteorologists. So not only can you look within the app and zip around and see what's going on, looking at the fronts, looking at pictures, looking at storm chaser video, but if you click on that icon right at the bottom of the buttons there at the bottom of the app, if you, it looks like a little play button, hitting that takes you to the video portal, and within that we have daily forecast information. We also have documentaries that we've shot, weather reports, and in fact our chief Leslie Hudson is going to be having some new Hurricane Dorian content coming soon, as we're trying to work things out with getting to the Bahamas and getting a firsthand look at things there. So tons of new content coming to that video portal on a daily basis. So if the app is not giving you your fill of weather, we've got you covered. Even during a live event as well, we were on a rotating schedule during Hurricane Dorian, keeping people updated, not only live in the app, but on social media too. So it's full service here at MyRadar for sure.
Well, I'm seeing Lorenzo is on the app right now, or is up on MyRadar, but we have a whole bunch of high pressure sitting off the coast of the U.S. Do you think that's going to prevent Lorenzo from getting as close enough to doing damage?
Yeah, I don't think Lorenzo is going to be a threat to the United States really at all. It looks like it's heading off to toward Europe, really. But what an incredible storm to see that thing form as strong and as defined as it did in that part of the Atlantic. So believe me, we had plenty of users that were sending us pictures tracking along, right along with us, sending us DMs on social media. So it's, again, a really powerful tool to not only know whether or not it's going to rain, but even to your point, looking at hurricanes all the way off in the Atlantic. And now we have a new feature where you can see precipitation all across the globe, looking at using a combination of satellite and radar information globally. So each and every app update that we put out, there's a new exciting feature. So more to come for sure.
Now, this seems like it's taking a ton of information, a ton of data, and combining it, condensing it into this really a beautiful graphic interface here that helps me see flows and things like that. But, like, where does this information come from?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of it is, of course, coming from the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, or, of course, NOAA. So we're taking the information that, you know, with they have and with the radar stations they have set up all across the United States, couple that with, again, getting satellite data from various sources, too. We can smooth everything out and make it look more concise rather than it being a big mess. Of course, if you have the pro features unlocked in the app, you can go station by station by station and see things going on in a more hyper-local level that will also give you the velocities, too. So if you want to take, you know, the next step with chasing storms or following along with tornadic supercells, you can do that by looking at the velocity as well as the reflectivity, too. So, again, there's so many layers, so many features that you can turn on and off, whether it's in the free app or in the upgraded versions of the app. There's so much that you can do. Again, even on a simplest level, or if you want to take things to the extreme with aviation and the TripIt integration and follow along severe weather, so much that you can do.
Excellent. Well, Mike, thank you very much for all that information.
Absolutely.
Matt, what you got?
Mike, one real quick question, and again, this is kind of like a little bit off topic, but I think that it's always good for our listeners when we have the opportunity to talk to somebody like you and especially meteorologists, being able to ask them these questions. Does my radar or you personally have any opinion on the storm naming for winter storms? I know that there was some back and forth on whether that was a good idea or not. I'm just curious to know if you guys have kind of an opinion, as an organization as to, whether that was a good decision or how that's panning out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. So, of course, speaking on, in terms of the entire company, I wouldn't necessarily have something there, but me, at least my opinion of that, and I think this goes along somewhat with some things that we've kicked around as well, it seems like it only ceases to potentially add to more confusion. The key with weather is to have everybody on the same page, whether it is a severe thunderstorm or whether it is a winter event. It seems like there are other organizations out there that want to throw out the branding and the marketing to benefit themselves. But at least, again, in my opinion, that only ceases to kind of add to more confusion, where we need to have everybody on the same page following a concise message. And I think that especially the National Weather Service are really doing that moving forward with the way that they have changed their advisories, watches, and warnings moving forward, especially when that pertains to winter weather, something that can on a dime change so quickly. So I think that it certainly adds to a little bit of confusion when you start throwing out these names, which are typically only reserved for tropical events. So at least that's my opinion on the matter. I think things get a little bit muddled already in the world of weather where, you know, things like as simple as even like a wet bulb, dry bulb temperature, even something like the dew point, something that even when I was on television doing forecasts, that's a, you know, a weather parameter that's really, really important that affects you on a daily basis. But as soon as you start throwing those words out there, people tend to tune things out a little bit. So adding more information or adding more names and things like that only cease to kind of muddy the waters a little bit. So the more concise and clear that we can keep things, the more on the same page everyone will be. And I certainly think that the public is really turning a huge page in that regard. Never more than ever are we more interconnected than we are now in our history. And I feel like a lot of people are super educated with the weather. And we are finding that on a daily basis with our interactions on social media. So it's all good things moving forward for sure, but I feel like the key is to stay concise and then we can all move forward together.
That makes a lot of sense and, you know, kind of couple, you know, leading on that with regards to your mention of education. You know, obviously our listeners, being aviation enthusiasts are always looking to learn more about weather and meteorology in general. What would you recommend as a meteorologist to something that if our listeners are looking to learn more about whether it's fronts or whether it's identifying, you know, low versus high pressure systems, et cetera, what's something that would be a good starting point for them to learn, and how could they use your app to improve their knowledge of that?
Well, that's a great question too. I mean, if you were to say, hey, you want to try building this birdhouse, for you to just tell me to do that without any kind of instruction may be a bit difficult. But if you provide me the tools to do so, I should be able to take those steps to reaching that conclusion. So that's where we come in within that video portal too. We have tutorial videos with how people can learn to not only use the app, but to further their weather knowledge by understanding how to use the app. Even if it's something really simple with, I don't understand the fronts layer, or I don't understand what these parameters under the radar layer mean. So we've got you covered there with the tutorial videos that are really easy to follow along, and you can have your phone right next to you kind of not only following along, but trying things out for yourself. So we've got you covered in that regard when it comes to the video information. And on a daily basis, we are trying to figure out more content to push out, whether it's the forecasts or whether it's something simple like you touched on for the education, because that is certainly something that we are very, very big on here, trying to be sure that we are busting all of those weather myths, that, again, everyone is on the same page when it comes to what is happening in a particular weather event, because an educated public is just going to really benefit us in the long run, especially when things tend to get a little crazy when it comes to severe weather, whether it's tornadoes in the spring season or hurricane season now for folks that live on the coast, or even earlier more than ever dealing with snow. So everyone just needs to be on the same page as far as the education and the understanding. And we've got you covered with those video tutorials, as well as the education videos coming on a daily basis. We've got a really awesome, dedicated team here. And again, education is our number one goal. So we've got you covered.
Excellent. And for those of you who may have a passion, as it clearly comes through, Mike, that you have a passion for what you're doing out there, are you guys hiring? Is there a place that people can go to apply for a job?
That's, as far as the hiring, that's going to be above my pay grade. But we love the interaction with people. That's the beauty of the times that we're living in right now. Never before did you have access to, you know, a scientist. When you ask people, you know, who's the scientist that you have the most direct access to, more than likely the first name that's going to pop up is whether it's a television meteorologist or someone like us on our team here. So there's no such thing as a stupid question. So feel free to reach out to us. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're MyRadarWX on all of those platforms. Send us a DM even. Our DMs are open on Twitter. That's going to be fun, inviting that. But our DMs are open on Twitter. Feel free to send us a question if you have one. And if you are out and about taking videos, taking pictures, we love that too, because radar information is great, being able to look at something on radar, you know, hundreds, thousands of miles away. But getting that ground truth, you know, seeing videos, seeing images, that's really, really important stuff, especially during winter weather, too, to be able to see the rate at which snowfall is falling, how much we have. We work with a storm chaser. His name's Aaron Jajak. He just used a bag of Skittles recently to measure the snow out in Montana. What crazy video that is, by the way. But yeah, we love the interaction with people on social media, within the app. So please reach out to us, MyRadarWX, on all of the socials. And of course, subscribe to the YouTube channel too. You can comment and reach out to us that way. We are very, very transparent. There's a human being on the other end when you are sending us a question. So if you have any of them, feel free to send it. We will try our best to answer them.
Excellent. Well, if you're looking to utilize My Radar app, head on over to the App Store, Google Play. You can even get it from Microsoft for your computer. And, Mike, is there anything else that you want to say?
Yes, brand new to the game as well. We actually just put out an Xbox version of the app, too. Mm-hmm. So if you do have an Xbox console at home, you can download the app there, and using the Xbox controller, you can zip around on the global map looking at all of the weather information, turning those layers on. You can even have the videos playing in the corner while you're doing so. So a really, really powerful tool to be able to follow along those tutorial videos, kind of trying things out for yourself as you're watching the video. And there's plenty more exciting content versions of the app in the pipeline. We're only getting started here, even though the company's been around for a while. So stay tuned. We have lots of cool stuff coming.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mike, for joining us today, and we wish you all the best in the future.
Thanks, guys. This was a blast. I really enjoyed it.
Mike, awesome. Thank you for your time. Really appreciate it. So, all right. Topic three for the day. Rob, how was Nationals?
Nationals. Oh, it was good. It was good. Nationals was a blast, and it was I don't know how to say it. I mean, it was the culmination of so much work put in by so many people. And I had my own little adventure in all of this. Like, I was preparing a student to go, and that was the sole focus for the majority of my summer, you know, at least after Oshkosh, was getting them ready. And Nationals is a week of flying aerobatics and competition and things like that. But for me, it was at least 2 weeks from the time I left the house, because I went down to meet with a student and I did multiple days flying with them. And then I left there with the aircraft. So I actually ferried the aircraft from the New York area out to Salina, Kansas, and in an effort to have it ready for the student who had a real job, you know, who needed to be at work and could only get so much time off. Whereas, you know, when this is the job, boom, you got the time. But Nationals this year was at Salina, Kansas for the first time ever, after last year being at Oshkosh for the first time ever, after normally being hosted down in Texas. And the journey that Nationals took to get to Salina was multi-part, with Mountain State University and their program researching, okay, what airports are kind of right in the middle of the aircraft, so it's in the middle of the country, so it's equidistant for competitors to get here, that has adequate airspace, good facilities, good runways, good ground markings, like all these kind of elements. And they narrowed it down to a handful of airports, and then a committee went to all these different airports and looked at the facilities and looked at the airspace and looked at everything, and they narrowed it down to Salina. And my goodness, I don't think they could have got it more right. This was my first Nationals. I've never been to it before, so I don't have a baseline other than this. However, the folks that had been to multiples over the years were really happy with everything here, the facilities, the weather, the box. The tower was great. The tower controllers were great, very accommodating, and the people who were a part of Salina and the operations at the airport were great and welcoming and excited to have us. So, I mean, they set up right away an atmosphere of welcome, and that was awesome. So to be out there was really cool. Was one of the first ones out there. I got out there on Wednesday, and I was joined in Ohio. I flew out Tuesday evening, got to Ohio, and spent the night in Ohio. I was joined out there by two pilots whom I had flown and competed with in New England. They came out from Connecticut, and we all met up at Akron Fulton Airport. Now, Akron Fulton Airport is a really awesome airport that used to be home of the Goodyear blimp, and it has a very, very massive hangar that is now home to Lockheed Martin, but I believe was built by the United States Navy and housed the dirigible program back predating World War II. Now, that's a very historical field. And it is a stone's throw from where I went to college at Kent State University. So I flew into Kent, spent the night at Kent, and interestingly, as I was arriving at Kent, there was a Cessna 120 that was coming in as well, and the line crew announced on the CTAF to the guy in the 120 that the fuel pumps were broken at Kent. They weren't going to be able to give him any gas, so if he needed any, he'd have to go someplace else. And he said, "Nah, it's fine." And I'm sitting there going, "How much gas do I have left on board? Can I get down to okay? Yeah, all right. I got 45 minutes of gas on board. Oh no, I got an hour and 15 minutes. Okay, yeah, that's fine. I can make it down to Akron Fulton tomorrow morning if we can't get these pumps fixed. You know, it's not a big deal." So I ended up spending the night there and got to shake hands with a lot of people that I went to school with, and got to show some people the airplane and talk a little bit about what I was doing there was spread aviation and also going out to nationals. But the following morning, the other two guys showed up in a Piper Saratoga and an extra 300L. And I was also in an extra. So we did a three ship out to Salina, Kansas, stopping in Bloomington, Illinois, which there's a cool little air museum out there as well. But we were only there really long enough to get some gas and run to McDonald's and grab some sandwiches and then get back in the airplanes and blast off. So with the formation, we had the Saratoga in the lead because he was the best equipped. And I was flying number two off the wing, and then the other extra was number three, bringing up the tail of the formation. And I joined up on the lead ship, and I'm flying along, and we're up at 6,500 feet or so, cruising along at 140 knots, you know, conserving the gas. And I look over, and I key the microphone on the second radio, and I go, "Are you eating a sandwich?" He goes, "Yep, chicken." I go, "Oh, I'm jealous, because, like, he's got the autopilot on. I'm sitting there hand flying an unstable aircraft." And he goes, "And now I'm drinking my iced tea." And he like looks out the window at me and smiles and takes a sip through the straw. And I'm like, "Aw." But like it was cool to be able to be that close to see that detail. And then we could talk on the radio. So I had two comms. He had two comms, but the other extra only had one. So he had to kind of flip flop. And if ever, whenever we get a new radio frequency, because we're going cross country, we're talking all these different approaches on flight following, we would all get the frequency and lead would switch and we'd check in 2, 3. And then he'd announce to the approach controller, you know, "This flight of three is checked in with you." But then every once in a while, we wouldn't hear from three. And he's only got one radio. And so if I needed him on the other radio, if I needed him on the other frequency because he wasn't monitoring our air-to-air, I'd waggle the wings, and then he'd switch over, and he'd check in, and I'd let him know what frequency we're on. And he goes, "Okay, thanks," and then he'd check in with us. So it was a neat little system that we'd worked out and gotten to implement. And we all got out there safely, and we had tailwinds the whole way out. So we had a ground speed of about 185, 190.
Oh, awesome.
Which is weird going east to west. You know, you don't normally get that, but we were riding a high pressure that was up to the north, and the rotation of that was blowing us all the way there. So that was awesome. So that's the journey out. Being one of the first ones there.
Now I'll interrupt you there for a second. So
yeah, go ahead.
Quick question on the way out. Would that be a situation with that extra only having one radio where a handheld might have proven helpful?
Not really, unless you can daisy chain it into your headset, because those airplanes are so darn loud, you're not going to hear anything if you take your headset off.
Got it.
So, I mean, not really. I mean, you're almost better off texting, but even then, service is spotty at best. Good luck. So, waggling the wings was a very clear sign. Hey, I got to check in. So,
yep,
it was effective. The other side of things, too, is, you know, you keep each other in sight. So I wasn't just watching lead. I was also looking back and making sure three was okay and still in position. Because if he disappears, well, then, okay, we got to figure this out. But, yeah, I mean, you all work together and communicate. And there's a whole bunch of different systems in place as well. Like, we don't need to reinvent the wheel, but there's even training that you can do on formation flying and how to do that effectively and safely. But being one of the first people out there, it was nice because I could hang out at the airport, and as other competitors arrived, participants arrived, I could be there to give them a bottle of water because, I mean, it was Kansas. It was still warm out, and we're flying airplanes that don't really have air conditioning. Give them a bottle of water, help them push the airplane into the hangar and get gas and all kinds of stuff. So basically got to shake hands or meet everybody that was coming in and say hi, and everybody was really nice. So it was cool to meet people who we've met before. Jim Burke, we met at Oshkosh, and I've seen his work and stuff that he's done online. He's a U.S. Unlimited competitor. Rob Holland came out. He's from just up the road in New Hampshire. We talked to him a little bit at Oshkosh as well. and some folks that I hadn't seen in a couple of years, like Mike Siliberti and Angelo Silerato, the guys that I've competed with in New England. But because I took 2018 away from the sport, you know, hadn't seen them for a while. So it was nice to see those guys and catch up and reaffirm kind of that brotherhood it's very interesting meeting those guys, because it doesn't matter how long it's been since you've seen each other, you fall right back into the relationships that you had with them before, and just immediate brotherhood. So it's really neat. But being there to coach meant that when competitors were up on their practice days, and Thursday and Friday were practice days, I could be on the ground with a radio watching them in the box and giving them feedback and critiques and coaching. And we had monstrous winds out of the south the first couple of days. They were 30 to 40 knots in the aerobatic box. And that makes it very, very tough, because you have to wind correct all of your figures to make them look like they look on paper, to make them perfectly round. Well, if you've got a 40 knot headwind at one part of the loop and a 40 knot tailwind at the other part of the loop, that's going to change its shape unless you know how to compensate for that with your airplane. And so on the coaching side, I got to talk to a lot of people on the radio. They you got to relax here, pull harder here, to let it float here, do this stuff, and be able to give them the feedback to help them out, you know, going forward. But the problem is, that's a practice day. You have no idea what the wind's going to do when it's actually time for your competition flight. So you kind of have to take all that data and be able to make the airplane do what you want it to do. But all the competitors have the same basic conditions when they go up to fly. So everybody's, it's you versus the elements, it's you and your airplane versus the elements. So the first couple of days I was coaching and critiquing, from the ground. And then when it came time for the contest, I'd made sure that I'd introduced myself to the volunteer coordinator and say, hey, you know, whatever you need, I'm a regional judge. I can help you out with recording or assisting or whatever you need on the judge's line. You know, she said, oh yeah, that's great. So I ended up being a recorder for Sportsman, an assistant judge for intermediate, and an assistant judge for advanced. And that means that you're out on the judge's line. You're as close to the action as possible. You're about 600 feet or so from the edge of the box, and the competitor's right there in front of you, altitudes from 3,000, 4,000 down to, in advance, like down to 600 feet. So it's very close. It's right there. It's the best seat in the house. But in Salina, we were out in the middle of a soybean field. So they'd actually cut out a swath of soybeans, and we had our chairs and tents and tables and everything set up, porta potties and all that. And they put us in vans, drove us across the runways, out on the taxiways. They had closed down these other runways, and actually had us out there in the middle of this Class Delta airport, sitting underneath the aerobatic box. It was great. It was a lot of fun. Huh. And
now, is this the one where you
get all that burned?
Is this the one where you got to sit on the runway at one point?
Yeah. We had three different positions were used for the judges. They had the judges on the east side of the box, the west side of the box, and then for advanced and unlimited, because of what the winds were doing, they decided to use east-west or west-east winds, B and C forms, and that put the judges on the southern boundary for those competitions. Now, the southern boundary...
Now, can you explain that to our listeners, just in case they're not familiar with, because I myself am not familiar with aerobatics in general, at least in this regard. What do you mean by that exactly?
So the aerobatic box is literally just that. It's a three-dimensional box. It's roughly 3,000 feet high, 3,000 feet long, and 3,000 feet deep. And the judges need to sit 600 feet beyond the edge of it to get a good look at aerobatics. And in Salina's case, the box was north, south, east, and west. The center line of the box, running right down the middle, was runway 18 over at Salina. Now they have runway 17. They also have a runway 18, which is much smaller. And then they have a couple of diagonal runways that cut it down the middle like an X. And because runway 18 cut the box right down the center, when you were using the east to west portion of the box, the east to west direction of the box, you needed to have the judges down on the south end. And that put you right on the center line of runway 18 in all the judges' chairs. So we're sitting out there in all these lawn chairs, middle of this closed runway, kind of constantly looking around to make sure that nobody's, you know, coming into land. But the super interesting thing was the gliders, because there are gliders at this competition as well that fly aerobatics. They were getting towed and launched off of 3-6. So they were actually taking off a quarter mile or so, 1,000 feet in front of us, not really close enough that we could hear them. But they were taking off 1,000 feet in front of us, away from us, and then the tow planes and the gliders were recovering to the diagonal runways. So they weren't ever really coming towards us at any point. We were never in any kind of harm's way. But it was very neat to see them taking aircraft off, taking the gliders off, towing the gliders off from the runway in front of us. But for the most part,
surprised they didn't put any red X's on the. I'm sorry. I'm surprised they didn't put any X's on the runway to indicate that you guys were sitting there, right? Those big.
Well, they had it notamed closed, and they did have X's. But the operation for the gliders and the tow plane was exempt from the notam. So it was normal operation for them. They were the only ones that were allowed to use those runways. I don't remember specifically where the X was, and I may actually be thinking of the box markers, because they did have a box marker on the runway as well. And the box marker is just like a big white uppercase T that symbolizes the middle of the box.
And then, all right, well, how was the end of the trip?
Well, am I done talking about the middle? I think I'm done talking about the middle. Salina was great. The Chamber of Commerce had a social for us, so they hosted a dinner. They had a barbecue food truck out there right on the ramp, so everybody was getting barbecue. Some of the best barbecue. The problem was Hillary said something about making sure you eat healthy, and I'm like, everything out here is barbecue. I don't know that I can necessarily do that. Yeah. Fantastic barbecue, fantastic friends. We went out most every night. There were some nights I was just too weather beaten after sitting out in the soybean field all day to go out. So
did you wear your sunscreen this time?
To the room and, oh yeah, I had tons of sunscreen on. Nice. I'm actually disappointed in the tan; it's already gone. Not like Oshkosh.
That was burn. That was burn, Rob. That was burn.
It was a good burn. But no, there were some nights where I was just so exhausted that I wasn't going to go out. And then I was still doing a little bit of work from the hotel room too. So, being away, kind of catch up on things, as you're going. And then, see here. So my student was done Thursday. They actually did 4 flights of sportsmen, with the 4th flight, being scored individually. It wasn't for anything. It wasn't for the rest of the competition. So my student, being at their second contest ever and their first time at nationals, having only flown aerobatics really for the last year, placed 10th, and that is an outstanding result. Wow, for yeah. that amount of time and that hard of work put in. And I mean, the people that were ahead had been doing it for years, and even some of the people that were behind it had more than, I mean, there were some folks that had more than 20 years of aerobatic experience, and I know there was one guy who had 17 years in his aircraft that he was competing in, worth of experience, and my student did even better than him. So I'm pleased with that result. And they still flew very well, and it just happened that's where the scores landed. But extremely, extremely proud of my student, and very happy that they were able to go out there and perform and execute the training to the level that they did. You know, really nice job. And got some praises from some folks who had been in this for a while, some very big names. Were like, hey, that was actually really well flown. So really, really proud, and a great job. I'm very, 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 very pleased with how they flew. So that's awesome.
Well, that must be, as an instructor, it must be awesome to feel that way about your student. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like a proud parent moment a little bit. And they have committed, they've signed up for 2 more years of training at least. So that's kind of the good news. They're going to continue, and they want to move up in category. So that's going to be a lot of fun teaching all that and continuing to do that. So they were done on Thursday. Friday? I think it was Friday. Man, the problem is that whole week was a complete blur. So Friday, since the airplane was done and I wasn't needed for any more of the categories, I left Friday morning once we got the airplane pulled out of the hangar and gassed up. I left and headed back east and had even stronger tailwinds. I had 60 knots on the tail at 5,500 feet.
Wow.
Going eastbound as I was approaching Chicago. And you were actually trying to get on an airliner out of Chicago.
I was.
At the time. And you were like, come pick me up. And I'm like, the reason that you're delayed is the reason I can't come pick you up. There were some nasty thunderstorms. I was
well. In my defense, I was going to take an Uber to Southern Illinois if I had to. So you know.
Yeah.
But
I was trying to get to. Where was I trying to get to? I think I was trying to get to Illinois University. They have a flight program. I was trying to get to their airport, and I was looking at the weather radar, and there was a big gap that was in between where I was and where they were, and I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, I can make that. And I was watching it on the ADS-B weather start to close up, and I went, oh, well, I mean, I can beat it, but even if I beat it, then I'm sitting on the ground as this thunderstorm hits the airport. Like, why would I even think about doing that? So then I just was like, okay, well, you know, I got tons of gas. Let's just go over here to the south because I can see the southern edge of the storm. So if I land west and west of it and still on the south edge, by the time I'm full of gas, that storm's moving north. It's going to clear you know, where I am, and I'll just motor on my way. It's no big deal. So I ended up landing at this airport that, as I was approaching it, I thought, man, this would be like a great place to have an aerobatic box. This place looks pretty good. Looks really cool. And so had joined the right traffic, 'cause that's what the airport wanted, and I land there, pull in, get some gas, and as I'm filling up, this gentleman comes out and starts talking to me. He's the CFI at the airport, and by golly, I can't think of the name of it right now. Hold on, I get it for you in 1 second. But he's talking to me about, you know, what the airplane is and what it's for, and I'm like, yeah, it's an aerobatic airplane. And he goes, oh, yeah, there's a couple of pizzas that are based here, and we actually have an aerobatic box that's right over here. And I'm like, oh, that makes a lot of sense because this place is perfect. And the airport was Litchfield, 3 Lima Foxtrot. It's got an east-west and a north-south runway that don't intersect each other, but to the southwest side of these two runways is this perfect place to have an aerobatic box, and by golly, they do. So I was talking with him a little bit, but unfortunately I couldn't stay, and I wasn't outfitted to play. So I kind of shook his hand and said, well, you know, it's nice to meet you. I got to go. And I continued on to Kent State, where they finally had gas and filled up there. And as I checked the weather for the last leg of the flight, weather looked good all the way to the destination airport. And did the math real quick and was like, okay, yeah, I'm going to land about 15 minutes, 20 minutes before sunset. And, okay, so let's go. Blasted off. And as I was flying, I kept redoing the calculation, making sure that I was going to land before sunset. And in fact, yep, I did. Everything was looking good. And as I approached the airport, they asked, which runway I wanted because the winds were calm. So I elected for the straight in runway, but I requested an overhead break, which is where you fly in over top of the runway, a little bit higher than pattern altitude, and then at some predetermined point, either over the numbers or over the midfield or 1,000 footers or whatever, you just roll into basically a crosswind, downwind, base, final. It's just one continuous descending turn to the runway. And so I flew that, and that let the folks know who could open the hangar that, hey, it was coming in. And so they met me out at the airplane, opened the hangar. We put it away for the night. It was a great night. And then from there, drove 5 hours home. So, I mean, it was a really awesome trip.
All right. So, Rob, that was awesome. Thanks for talking about Nationals. Like, I was very interested in hearing about how that went. I saw the stories on Instagram, et cetera, and I'm sure our listeners did too. Keep us posted on.
And anybody can volunteer for that too. You don't have to be a pilot or an aerobatic competitor or anything like that. You can volunteer for these things as well. And we always need volunteers. It takes 17 volunteers to put one pilot in the aerobatic box.
17? Well, we'll have to talk about that next time.
Between. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's something to talk about. That's something to talk about. So today's online question, and this is actually coming from a private pilot, is it's interesting. I'm actually kind of curious about this too. I'm a little nervous when I'm trying to figure out whether or not to declare an emergency. When should I and when should I not declare an emergency, particularly around the health of a passenger? It's an interesting question.
Declare it. That's the easy one. Just declare it. If there's ever a question of, oh, should I or shouldn't I, just declare it. Mayday, mayday, mayday. I need this, because that's what the declaration of an emergency gets you. It gets you whatever you need to handle whatever situation you're in. And if it's a sick passenger, if it's your landing gear fell off, if it's you're running low on gas, declare, okay? And it will get you the priority. And I think we've even talked about in the past, like the low on gas thing, there was a twin engine airplane who overflew, I think it was Pope Air Force Base, because the controller told him you're not allowed to land there, and he was getting low on gas. Land there! You know, and unfortunately, they ended up crashing short of their destination. They had to overfly Pope Air Force Base, try to get to the next place, and they didn't make it there. They could have made Pope and landed and maybe had to truck in some gas, they would have been alive to do it. So if there's ever a question of whether you should or shouldn't declare the emergency, okay, especially if it's a situation where you're saying, I need to do this, and a controller is saying, I can't give that to you, not like I'm trying to get through Chicago's airspace at 9,500 feet, and they're saying, no, go around or go over. That's just me trying not to go around. No, I'm not saying declare the emergency there, but if you have a situation and the shortest distance to help is below you into controlled airspace or whatever, declare the emergency, go in there, land the airplane, get the help, take care of the situation. And having declared a handful of emergencies in the past, here's a couple things that I got to experience. I got to meet some firefighters who were really excited to see me. I got on the news once. And one time I had to fill out a little bit of paperwork that was, hey, tell us what happened. That was all it was. Okay. There's not some big old thing that goes on. It's not a big deal. It is you doing what you need to do, taking that pilot and command authority and taking care of the situation. So if you're ever questioning, should I declare an emergency right here? Declare the emergency. Take care of the situation.
All right. That's really good advice. And I think it's an awesome way to wrap up, our latest episode, episode 27. Thanks, Rob, and thanks to listeners. Instagram, Spread Aviation, Facebook, Spread Aviation, YouTube, Spread Aviation. We are super close to the amount of followers we need to get our Spread Aviation handle, so please follow us on YouTube if you haven't already. Rob, anything else?
I got nothing, man.
Hello at SpreadAviation.com.
And there's a handful of people who have used the chat functionality to talk to me. Thanks, you guys, for sharing that. You know, keep it up.
All right. Take care. Fly safe.